like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land in which we are recording and listening to this podcast, and the land on which we defend human rights. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge that this land always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Welcome back to Season 3 of Activist Connect, the podcast to engage, educate, entertain, and connect amnesty activists across Australia. I'm your host, Tiana, and welcome to Episode 3 of our Climate Justice mini-season of the podcast. In this episode, we're going to be exploring what an intersectional approach to social justice is and why the climate justice space should also take an intersectional approach. Intersectionality focuses on how social categories like gender, race, socioeconomic class, ability, sexual orientation, religion, and other aspects of our identity interact on multiple levels, contributing to discrimination, exclusion, or social inequality and systemic injustice. In 1998, scholar and civil rights advocate Kimberley Crenshaw coined the term intersectionality when she observed that gender and race were looked at as complete separate issues. To Crenshaw, studying them in isolation to each other made no sense, because women of colour, for example, were doubly discriminated against, particularly in law. Now, if you haven't watched her TED Talk, I definitely recommend checking it out after this episode. Taking an intersectional approach to social justice as activists means working to identify and understand how overlapping categories of identity may impact individuals and institutions, and take these relationships into account when we are working to promote social change. We should all apply this theoretical framework to understand how aspects of a person's social and political identities might combine to create unique modes of discrimination. So, what's the relationship between intersectionality and climate justice? In recent years, climate justice organizations in various regions of the world have begun to take an explicit intersectionality focus, with different challenges and results. The following is an excerpt from Henya Balelia, a French-Algerian climate justice and migrant rights defender, who describes some of the reasons why intersectionality is especially relevant to the climate justice movement. In her words, "In the climate justice movement, an analysis of intersectionality helps explain why we cannot simply fight for a greener, cleaner version of this current system by reducing emissions, stopping deforestation, and shifting to renewable energies like wind and solar. The collapse of our ecosystems and disasters like hurricanes and oil spills have always impacted certain people more than others. Usually, it's also those very communities who have less access to resources, such as reliable housing, that would help them survive the economic devastation that comes with the ecological collapse. We must remember, intersectionality isn't only structural, it's also personal. Most of us carry with us an overlapping layer of privilege and oppression. As a migrant woman of colour born into a working class family, I may understand what being on the front lines of multiple oppressions look like, but I also have the privilege of the economic and social access that my college education, mixed race, and part of family's transition into the middle class have offered me." Glossing over these very real distinctions ends up allowing historical oppressions to continue to play out unchallenged, minimising, silencing, and erasing certain voices. On a bigger scale, we need to provide resources and access to those who don't have them in ways that are not tokenizing. Organizers have to stop talking of empowering people on the margins as if they didn't have their own power already. It's about getting out of the way for others to take up space while valuing the fact that power already exists in marginalized communities. It's about understanding our own identities, where we benefit from the system and where we don't, and taking responsibility for our layers of privilege in how we move about the world. It's about established organizations being watchful of the inequalities they perpetuate, especially in terms of access to resources and to the job market within the nonprofit complex. Through all of this, we have to commit to working slowly in spite of the urgency of our crisis and holding ourselves accountable when destructive dynamics arise. Ooh, that is a lot to take in, but it is so empowering and so insightful. I just had to include it in the episode today. So, unlike the mainstream environmental climate movement, the climate justice approach to climate change places at the centre of its work populations that are particularly vulnerable to social and economic injustices, but also the social and economic injustices that might come with the impacts of climate change. As climate justice activists, it's our job to seek to address the inequalities and discrimination that are generated or fueled by the impacts of climate change, and to do so with an intersectional approach. We need to understand which communities are most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. In this episode, I'm going to dive deep into two specific groups of people who are most vulnerable to climate change. Indigenous peoples are among the communities most impacted by climate change, here in Australia and globally. They often live in marginal lands and fragile ecosystems, which are particularly sensitive to alterations in the physical environment. They maintain a close connection with nature and their traditional lands on which their livelihoods and cultural identity depend. According to the United Nations, the potential threat of climate change to Indigenous peoples' very existence, combined with various legal and institutional barriers which affect their ability to cope with and adapt to climate change, makes climate change an issue of human rights and inequality to Indigenous peoples. Enhancing and supporting the adaptive capacity of Indigenous peoples will only be successful if it is integrated with other strategies like disaster preparation, land use planning, environmental conservation, and national plans for sustainable development. In many instances, adaptation to new conditions requires additional financial resources and the transfer of technological capacity that most Indigenous communities do not possess. While short-term adaptation activities are underway, resource and capacity constraints are limiting the implementation of long-term adaptive strategies. In Australia, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples have lived sustainably off this land since time immemorial. They have strong songlines across this country that connect one another to their culture and the land. Right now, 51% of the Northern Territory is covered in exploration licenses for oil and gas. If all of this went ahead, much of the Aboriginal-owned land would have country polluted with shale gas industries. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in Australia are especially vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. For those Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders in remote parts of Australia, increases in temperature will reduce the amount of bush tucker and native foods available to them. For people in coastal areas, rises in sea levels may force people off their land. This is especially concerning, considering the connection that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have to their country, and may result in poor mental health and other social issues. Extreme weather events like cyclones and floods will affect the infrastructure in remote Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities, and these communities may be cut off from services for long periods of time. It's becoming increasingly more evident that climate justice is not just an environmental issue, but one of human rights. So here are a few things that amnesty activists should think about in our own climate activism. While it's great to see many environmental organisations throwing resources into the fight for climate justice, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples have been fighting this fight for hundreds of years. How can the mainstream movement find ways to learn from Indigenous people and support them further? The climate movement is often criticised as being a very white space. Moving forward, we need to think about how Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples are leading the fight for climate justice here in Australia, and how we can centre the narrative, particularly in the media, about the work that they have been doing. Public figures like Greta Thunberg have done an excellent job at empowering youth to take action on climate change. But in the context of Australia, it's fair to assume that idolising figures like this at the expense of our Indigenous youth is doing an injustice for the Indigenous youth who are at the forefront of climate action here in Australia. Activists need to ensure they avoid tokenism and victimisation and ensure that we are creating a truly inclusive space. There also tends to be a media blackout when it comes to shining a light on the work of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. So how can we work to drive the focus away from predominantly white voices? I think it's important to share an organisation that you can support if you want to support our First Nations people in the fight for climate justice. SEED is Australia's first Indigenous youth climate network, who are building a movement of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander young people for climate justice with the Australian Youth Climate Coalition. Their vision is for a just and sustainable future with strong cultures and communities powered by renewable energy. Climate change is one of the greatest threats facing humanity, but they also know it is an opportunity to create a more just and sustainable world. SEED have campaigns to stop fracking in the Northern Territory and for land rights, not mining rights. If you want to learn more about SEED and support their work, I will leave more information in the episode description. Now, I want to move on to a gender approach to climate mitigation and adaptation. You may not think that feminism is an essential part of climate justice, but it is, because it illuminates how our extractive and dominating relationships with nature stem from patriarchy. If we want real climate justice, we need to recognize how our current system is shaped by patriarchy and how climate change will disproportionately affect women around the world. The United Nations indicates that 80% of people displaced by climate change are women. Immediately after natural disasters like Hurricanes Maria and Katrina, reporting shows that women faced an uptick in gender-based violence and harassment. Meanwhile, transgender people globally often report discrimination in natural disasters. One high-profile example from after Hurricane Katrina saw a trans woman locked in jail for days after she used the shower for women in a Texas shelter. In the aftermath, when cities and homes were rebuilt, women, trans, and non-binary people faced the steepest climb to recovery, and they're already more likely to be living in poverty. The International Women's Development Agency released a policy paper on gender and climate change in the Pacific and Asia. It's called Taking a Gender-Sensitive Approach to Climate Change Prevention, Mitigation, and Adaptation, and it shines a light on climate change and the gendered impacts that it has. It also looks at how Australia's policies and approaches can influence this. According to the policy paper, the impacts of climate change are gendered, meaning that men and women face different vulnerabilities to the impacts of climate change. Traditional gender norms mean that men and women occupy different roles in these societies, and it means that women often have higher levels of sexual assault and gender-based violence, lower levels of decision-making, high levels of gender discrimination, and poverty that exacerbates climate change risks for women and girls of all ages. Furthermore, LGBTQI plus people already face disproportionate exclusion and violence in most parts of the world, often having to flee their homes due to family conflict. In places where homeless shelters exist, LGBTQI plus people face the extra danger of homophobic and transphobic violence, which support workers are often not equipped to handle, which can push them even more onto the streets. In the context of the climate disaster, where housing is often the first and most primary site of loss, this creates an existential threat on a different scale for people and communities whose survival is already precarious. Now, Australia has a number of civil society actors that work on issues related to climate change, and as climate justice activists, it's our job to support these organisations and hold them accountable to ensure that they're using an intersectional approach in their work. Thank you so much for tuning into this final episode of our Activist Connect Climate Justice mini-season. We've covered some pretty heavy topics, like climate as a human rights issue, climate mitigation versus adaptation, and the importance of an intersectional approach to climate justice. And all of these topics will no doubt help you in your work as a climate justice activist, particularly after this pandemic when we can all get back out into our communities and start doing work. Activist Connect will be returning in 2021, but in order for us to broaden our audience reach and depth of topics, we want you, the Amnesty International community, to get more involved. As a grassroots movement, we want our podcast to reflect that and be a more participatory production. So if you think you'd like to host an episode, conduct an interview, or just share your insights with fellow Amnesty Australia activists, please reach out to us on our Instagram or Facebook at Activist Connect. I can't wait for Activist Connect to return in 2021. If you guys enjoyed this mini season or seasons 1 and 2, we'd really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Until next time, keep defending human rights.